This is America on the Road, winner of the International Automotive Media Conference Gold Medal Award for Radio, and now in its 24th year on the air. Thanks for being with us as we bring you the latest automotive information from around the world. America on the Road is brought to you by DrivingToday.com and the Coalition for Vehicle Choice. I'm Jack Nered. With me is Chris Teague. Chris, you've been under the weather a little bit. I hope you're feeling a little better.
Well, I'm still under the weather, but I am above board and on my feet. So I guess there's not too much more that can be asked for today.
Yeah, and you recently survived a storm that went through Maine and knocked some trees down and did some harm, didn't it?
Yeah, we got kind of the tail end of it. Isaias, I think, is how it's pronounced. And we were luckier than a lot of places. I think Connecticut got hit a little bit harder than we did. So not too many complaints. I can deal with the power being out.
Yeah. I remember when they named hurricanes with simple names that you could pronounce. But I guess that's not politically correct or something. I'm not sure why they're doing what they're doing, but they're doing it. I like Chris, but I am on the West Coast as opposed to on the East Coast, and it's a little foggy here today in the South Bay, but I think we're expecting to have a good day. And I have just taken delivery of a new 2021 Chevrolet Suburban, which I will drive through the remainder of the day and report on that in an upcoming show. So that's happening. In our road test segment today, we're going to be talking about the 2020 Toyota Highlander Hybrid, a vehicle I tested most recently. And give us a little hint about what you're going to be talking about, Chris.
I drove the 2020 Hyundai Venue, which both you and I drove together just right before the world started shutting down.
Yeah, absolutely. In Florida, it was a nice event, and we had a good time. We saw each other face-to-face, which is fairly rare since we're across country from one another, but that was terrific. And so that was good. We'll talk about that. Our special guest today is Kevin Quinn. He's with Mercury Insurance. He's their Vice President of Customer Experience and Claims. We'll be talking with him about the important issue of keeping young drivers safe. He's a real expert on this. I mean, he's experienced all of this very firsthand and has some really great tips on keeping young drivers safe. So we're going to be talking about that important issue. I've got three young drivers in my household, and you don't quite have that yet, Chris, but it's coming. And let me tell you, when your children start to drive, it's a whole different kind of revelation.
I'm going to savor the next decade between now and when that actually happens.
Yeah, there you go. Before we do any of that, though, we've got news to report to you. What's your top story, Chris?
Well, the big story for me, and I think a lot of people this week, is that the SEMA show in Las Vegas has been canceled. So that's the Specialty Equipment Market Association. That's a lot of the aftermarket parts suppliers and custom parts suppliers that you see. They get together every year in Las Vegas and have a grand old time. Was scheduled to take place, I think it was November 3rd through the 6th, or 2nd through the 6th, one of those two. And they canceled it yesterday with no concrete plans to reschedule. So I think we could see some sort of virtual combination event. They did mention that there was some positive responses from their vendors and exhibitors on that front, but quite a big announcement coming out of that world yesterday.
Absolutely. Very big announcement. And that's such a mammoth show. I've attended it many, many times. And it's one of the biggest auto shows out there, although they don't typically show that many new cars. But everybody in the aftermarket is there. It fills Las Vegas typically. And boy, try and get a cab during SEMA. It's always difficult. So, that's a multi-million dollar cancellation for certain. And but I guess you can't blame them if people are not willing to travel. It doesn't make a whole lot of sense to have a giant trade show.
No, and even if they were willing to travel, 160,000 people over the course of 3 or 4 days is probably not the best look right now.
Right. And we shall see. As of now, the Los Angeles Auto Show is still on, but we might get more information about that fairly soon, too. Well, another major, major story in the car industry is the fact that Jim Hackett, who has led Ford Motor Company as president and CEO since 2017, way far back as 2017, is going to retire from Ford. And Jim Farley, who is currently the chief operating officer there, is going to become president and CEO of Ford, effective October 1. Farley is a guy I know back from his days when he was, marketing VP at Toyota, and then went to Ford Motor Company, has continued rise through the ranks at Ford Motor Company since. He was elected to the Ford Board of Directors, and he will work with Hackett on the transition, and we'll see. I mean, it'll be interesting that Hackett wasn't really a car guy, and so and Farley certainly is. He's been through the mill, shall we say, and especially on the marketing side, but also on the product planning side and all of that. And it'll be interesting to see what happens with Ford Motor Company under Jim Farley's reign.
I agree. That's the big story around Farley, is that he's a car guy. He's into the product. So, but he does have his work cut out for him. They're coming up on some big restructuring plans and product launches. So, like you said, it will be interesting to see. But he'll have to hit the ground running.
Yeah,
for sure.
Well, I mean, I don't think anybody knows Ford Motor Company better than he does and their product plans and their product line. So that, I think, stands him in very good stead to make a difference there and make something happen. Because, like you say, the onus is on him to change things in a positive manner.
Agreed.
Another story is the Audi e-tron SUV family is out for 2021, or they've at least announced pricing on it. And good news for people who might want an e-tron is the price is actually going down. A decrease of close to $9,000 in the MSRP for the versus the earlier version of the e-tron. So that will be interesting. It also gets a little better in terms of efficiency. The EPA estimated range is 222 miles, which is an increase of 18 miles. And this is interesting to me, and maybe you have an explanation for this, Chris, because I sure don't. The e-tron Sportback, which is very much the same vehicle, a little bit different configuration, has an EPA estimated range of 218 miles. So if I'm doing my math right, that's a 4-mile difference, which doesn't seem even, you know, worth talking about. But any thoughts on why that is that?
I don't know, other than if there could be some alternate location of the batteries or some size differential there. But I really couldn't off the top of my head pick something out that would point to that, although it is almost negligible at 4 miles of range. So
right. Well, and before we go to the next segment, I want to plug a book, and I have nothing to do with this book, but it just seems like an interesting book. And I don't know, Chris, have you ever seen the abandoned cars calendars from Hemmings Motor News and those things?
I have.
And I there's something that touches me about them, and I have purchased them through the years. This is kind of about that same kind of thing. There is a photographer named Dieter Klein who has put together a book called Lost Wheels, The Nostalgic Beauty of Abandoned Cars. And like I say, I've got nothing to do with this, but you know, I've seen some of the photography, and it looks cool, and it has that kind of wistful, romantic look to it that these poor abandoned cars seem to have. They seem like lost puppies or something. So it's a book you might want to look for. It's not inexpensive. It's $55. The text is in English and German. So maybe you can not only look at the pictures, but learn to speak German by buying this book. So Lost Wheels.
Is this a coffee table size book?
Is 11 3/4 inches by 9 1/4 inches, according to the specs that I'm looking at. So it doesn't turn into a coffee table, a book about coffee tables. But it is probably appropriate for your coffee table.
Well, I'll have to check that out.
Yeah.
One of the things we do very well here in Maine is abandoned vehicles. So you never know what you're going to see driving
right
down the road. So,
right.
So check that out.
Yeah, well, you might want to start taking pictures, and maybe you can do your own book about abandoned cars.
Yeah, good side gig.
Yeah. So when we come back, we will be road testing the Toyota Highlander Hybrid and the Hyundai Venue. So two sport utilities of very different sizes. And stay with us for that. With Chris Teague, this is Jack Nerad right here on America on the Road. Welcome back, everybody, to America on the Road with Chris Teague. Jack Nerad back with you. And it is road test time right here on America on the Road. Of course, we're excited about this because this is what we do for a living. This is why we're doing what we do, why we're making the big money, is road testing cars and then telling you about them, hoping to help you make good buying decisions or just learn about what's going on out in the car world. Interesting vehicles for you, we think, this time around, the Toyota Highlander Hybrid. And Chris, you were testing the Hyundai Venue, probably a new name for a lot of people. Why don't you tell us about it?
Sure. Well, first of all, I'm glad at least one of us is making the big bucks, so I'm glad it could be you.
Yeah.
But the Hyundai Venue, so we mentioned earlier, you and I drove, we spent a day driving the Hyundai Venue back in January through the Florida Keys, and I had a great time driving it that day. And at the time, Hyundai had told us that they were pitching the car as a vehicle for young urban professionals, I believe were the words they used. And I didn't really get it at the time. In fact, I think a few of us actually kind of poked fun at that. But after spending a week with it on my own, I think I completely get it. So it's a compact, subcompact, probably crossover. It's very competitively priced. The one I tested, the SEL, with all the options, and it still came out to be under $23,000. There's no all-wheel drive, but front-wheel drive with selectable drive modes for like snow and slippery conditions. But the $23,000 gets a small crossover with a nice upscale interior, navigation, Apple CarPlay, Android Auto, power moonroof, decent amount of cargo space for such a small vehicle, and comfortable seats. So we've talked about this a few times. I have two young children. I have a three-year-old who is in a full-size car seat, no longer rear-facing, but still a big car seat. And then I have a seven-year-old who rides in a booster seat. And some vehicles, even those that are a little bit larger than the Venue, kind of struggle to fit those two seats in the back. I generally have to put the larger seat opposite of where I sit. So put them both in the Venue, tossed the kids in there, and was pleasantly surprised to find that they both had plenty of leg room. There were no bumped heads. You know, the roof is nice and tall. The door openings are squared and don't slope down too much, so there's enough room to put a kid in without bumping heads. And it's a comfortable ride. Now, it's not fast. It's not sporty really all that much, but it is comfortable and quiet, and it's a good around town cruiser and does pretty well on the highway too.
Yeah. And I think for that young urban person you're talking about, who maybe heads out to do some kayaking or biking or something like that on the weekends, there's plenty of interior space. It's not a very expensive car. A trend in this type of car is to not offer all-wheel drive because it just makes it that much more expensive. And if you add, let's say, $1,000 for all-wheel drive, that's going to price a lot of people out of the marketplace. So you get a bunch of stuff. You get all the requisite connectivity that you want. Nice, commodious interior that, as you say, can hold up to five people. And it seems like a really good situation for well less than $25,000.
I agree. And they've done a good job with the styling, too. You know, a lot of people have praised the Hyundai's larger crossover, I guess you could call it an SUV, the Palisade. And they've done a good job of bringing a lot of those kind of upscale or grown-up design elements down to the Venue. So the LED running lights up front and the shape of the front and the logo on the back tailgate are all kind of reminiscent of that larger vehicle and makes it look more expensive than it is, which I liked. And then fuel economy is good too. So they claim 34 miles per gallon highway. I think I actually did a little bit better than that. I think I averaged at 35 highway. So, you know, I think that the all around, there's not a lot to complain about if you go into it with your expectations aligned properly.
Right, right. And it's something to look at. You know, I'm not the young urban professional, but were I, and I guess one of my daughters certainly is, you know, it'd be a vehicle to look at. So there you go.
Certainly.
Yeah. Well, I was driving the Toyota Highlander Hybrid. And the Highlander is probably well known to folks. It's a three-row midsize SUV, very, very popular. A lot of high-quality sheen to it, certainly. And it is an example of what's going on at Toyota, where their hybrid models in each of their lines is essentially the top model and the most drivable of the models. That didn't used to be the case necessarily. Sometimes there was a little trade-off in drivability that you would give for the hybrid fuel efficiency. But this version of the Highlander, the 2020 Highlander, just has great drivability. The handoff between electric motor and the four-cylinder engine is very, very seamless. There are actually two electric motors in the system. 243 total system horsepower, and it delivers a manufacturer estimated 36 combined MPG, which is pretty good for a three-row vehicle. That's a big improvement over the previous generation Highlander Hybrid, which was about right around 30 MPG. Interestingly, it's available in two-wheel drive, which is front drive, and all-wheel drive, despite the fact that it has two electric motors. And I think that's an indication that they're looking for a broader spread of people, not just all-wheel drive folks, but people who want to spend a little less but still want the hybrid. And as you would guess, it has multiple driving modes, normal, eco, and sport. Pretty logical. And you would have that in the conventional non-hybrid as well, the Highlander non-hybrid. But then, of course, you get an EV mode, so you can sneak up on people. And I don't know that it does the CRV Martian spaceship noise thing that you talked about last week. It didn't seem to. All-wheel drive uses a separate rear-mounted electric motor to power the rear wheels, and it doesn't really connect up with anything else, but it just powers those rear wheels. And then there's all the safety stuff from Toyota Safety Sense 2.0, which we really are favorably impressed by. Pre-collision system with pedestrian detection, which is good. Full-range dynamic radar cruise control, so adaptive cruise control, which is a boon on long trips. Lane departure alert with steering wheel assist, automatic high beam. It's got good stuff. And finally, Toyota has gotten with the real world and made their infotainment systems, much, much better. One of the ways they did that was by adding Android Auto and Apple CarPlay. Now Android Auto, Apple CarPlay, Sirius XM, Waze, and Amazon Alexa compatibility are all standard. And the Highlander has a 12.3-inch multimedia display, so that's all good. And then there's the 7 or 8 passenger seating, and I kind of want your take on this, Chris, and I think it really has to do with how many kids you have. But the vehicle I had was configured with two captain's chairs in the second row and then a rear row fold-down seat that purportedly seated three. I think they would have to be kind of tiny three, maybe Barbie dolls or something like that to be in the back. You could probably get two kids back there without much problem. But what's your take on captain's chairs versus the bench seat? I think I probably know the answer, but let me know.
From a personal standpoint, I prefer captain's chairs, even though you supposedly lose that extra seat in the middle of the second row. The kids prefer it too, but my reasoning is that it keeps them far enough apart from each other that there's not any risk of getting handsy in the back seat. So there's no real conflict there unless they're dropping or throwing things at each other. What that does do, though, is if you have more than two kids, that puts one kid as the odd man out, or one or two kids as the odd person out, riding in the back row by themselves. And some kids prefer that, but some will feel lonely. So there have been a few instances where we've had three-row SUVs that we've owned and have done carpooling, and somebody ends up in the way back, as my wife calls it. And depending on the kid, they could be uncomfortable. Like I said, some people like it.
Yeah. I mean, the way back is not particularly comfortable, and I have three kids. They're now essentially grown, but when they were in three-row vehicles and with captain's chairs, one of them ended up back there, and she would typically get car sick back there because it's kind of claustrophobic, and also the ride motions toward the end of the vehicle are not as good as the ride motions in the middle of the vehicle. So it's not a great situation. If you have three kids, I would not recommend it. I recommend a bench seat there, which you can get. But if you got two kids, it probably works out just fine. What was kind of silly was the accommodations for quote-unquote three in the third row. I think that's a stretch.
I agree with that. And one thing Toyota does with their third row seats that I have a particular issue with is that they're very low to the ground. So even my 7-year-old, who is edging on 4 feet tall now, complains that the seat is too low, so her knees are kind of jacked up, and it can become uncomfortable for them. But smaller kids should be fine.
Right, right. Well, I agree with you. On the other hand, what we have here are two vehicles that I think we like pretty much. I would certainly recommend the Toyota Highlander Hybrid to families out there. I think it's quite a good value, and it sounds to me like you would recommend the Hyundai Venue to that young urban professional that we hear so much about.
I do, and I agree with your assessment of the Highlander.
Well, thank you very much. And what you said about the Venue was spot on. So hopefully we can travel again one of these days and see each other out on the road. When we come back, we're going to be talking with Kevin Quinn. He is with Mercury Insurance, their Vice President of Customer Experience and Claims, talking about that really important issue of teen and young driver safety. What an expert he is on this, and so we will be talking with him about that. And it's an extensive interview, so we're eschewing. We are not doing our listener calls and listener questions this week, but if you have one, join us again next week, and we will start answering those questions yet again. So with Chris Teague, this is Jack Nerad. Stay with us, please, right here on America on the Road. Welcome back to America on the Road. Jack Nerad back with you, and thanks so much for being with us. We really do appreciate it. We have a special guest for you right now. His name is Kevin Quinn. He is with Mercury Insurance, and he is an expert on teen and young person driver safety. He examines this through a microscope on a day-to-day basis, really sees the result of some poor driving habits, and has some great tips on maintaining the safety of your teen and younger driver. Kevin, thanks so much for being with us. We really do appreciate it.
Hey, Jack.
First of all, let's talk about what the inexperienced driver is, versus the experienced driver. And as someone who is looking at insurance data on a day-to-day basis, a minute-to-minute basis, what have you found about experienced older drivers versus younger drivers?
There's no question that experienced drivers get into less accidents than younger folks. And if you've ever had the privilege of adding teenage drivers to your automobile policy, you can see the big increase in rates. And there's a valid reason for that, because they are much more likely to get into an accident than an older, more experienced driver. Much more likely.
Yeah. And why do you think that is, Kevin?
You know, I think it's a combination of two things. It's a real challenge for young drivers because, first, they have to focus on their own driving skills, which takes a lot of concentration, but then at the same time, be very aware of what's happening around them, realizing that, hey, even if I'm doing a good job with my driving skill, which requires my focus, also being able to focus on the surrounding areas and, making sure that you're prepared if something were to go wrong. It's very difficult when you're learning a new skill to actually be able to do both at the same time.
And you're piloting a large machine the likes you've never handled before. So it certainly does take some experience to understand the dynamics of driving a vehicle.
Yeah, and I think a lot of teenage drivers can learn how to stay in the lane and follow the rules of the road. And what you'll find, though, is some more experienced drivers are really good at preventing accidents, despite bad behavior from people around them. So they have this incredible awareness of what's going on. And if something were to go wrong, they have really strong and quick reaction times, and they can avoid a lot of accidents that teenage drivers struggle to do.
Yeah, I mean, I have a saying that it really takes two mistakes very often to cause an accident. If the other driver is paying attention, they could maybe make up for the mistake by one person. But if a couple drivers are making mistakes, that's when really bad things can happen.
Yeah, and then younger drivers, because of their lack of experience, they tend to freeze, and then maybe even panic and not take the correct course of action. So, you think about a simple lane change accident. A more experienced driver will be aware whether the lane next to them on the left side is open if there's a car on the right. And then if that car starts to veer into that person's lane, they could quickly change lanes. But an inexperienced driver might panic and freeze, and then that's when the accident actually happens.
What do you think some of the biggest challenges that face an inexperienced driver, where they really trip up?
It's those moments of where things don't go correctly or as planned. And then, how do you execute and make sure that, you know, you're trying to avoid the accident? You know, it's a common scenario where you're driving along and everything seems normal, and then the car in front of you stops suddenly, you know, and being able to react to that quickly, even to the point where you're applying the brakes and maybe you can go to the left or the right to avoid that accident, is very difficult to both apply the brakes and then think about kind of an escape plan for our teen drivers. A lot of that, those kind of skills come with experience, and you learn that over time.
Absolutely. You're not, you don't come out of the womb knowing how to do that. That's for certain. What about the statistics? I mean, you're a statistician, I guess, in a lot of ways. You're looking at that on a day-to-day basis. What does it tell you about inexperienced drivers?
It's interesting because driving is the leading cause of death among teenagers. And in fact, in 2017, 1,830 drivers between the ages of 15 and 20 died in a motor vehicle accident. So it's a very serious issue.
Yeah, absolutely it is. And, you know, it's something that you and I are both parents of driving age children. And as I was talking to you before we started to record, that's one of the scariest moments for me is when my kids get in the car and they're off to drive somewhere. And they're super responsible kids, but that the statistics are very clear. And the statistics are also clear if they're driving with somebody else in the car with them. Talk a bit about both of those things, would you?
Yeah. So, you know, one thing that teenagers really struggle with is just keeping their eyes on the road and being focused. And they're a lot more easily distracted than maybe a person who's been driving for a long time. And so those distractions, and, you know, when you're a teenager, you tend to speed a little bit more and you feel a little bit more invincible than maybe someone who has more experience. So we found that, you know, speeding, distractions, and, you know, driving under the influence are some of the reasons why our teens get into more accidents than older adults who have more experience.
Yeah, I mean, it certainly gives parents headaches and maybe a nightmare or two, but there are things parents can do to help prepare their children. What are some of those things they can do?
The biggest thing they can do is be great role models, you know, at every opportunity. And even if, you know, they weren't the perfect drivers before, thinking about their children driving, they can change and become perfect drivers and really watch their speed, focus on the road, think about their surroundings. Don't be distracted by conversation. Don't look around to the person that's sitting behind you, wearing seatbelts. And of course, you know, always driving at a responsible speed. You'd be surprised at, you know, modeling that behavior, how teenagers will actually absorb that, and it can really be very, very helpful.
Yeah, absolutely. I can't endorse that any more heartily. Be a good role model, and they will tend to adopt your behavior. And I think that's especially true regarding seatbelt use, and certainly that is a critical safety factor. Talk a bit about that.
Yeah, sure. You know, 58% of teen driver-related deaths were a direct byproduct of our teenagers not wearing their seatbelt. And studies have shown that the teenagers are much more likely to not wear a seatbelt. In my job, I get to see, unfortunately, the byproduct of teenagers not wearing seatbelts. There is a remarkable difference between an accident where a teenager is wearing a seatbelt and one where they're not. And even in a very severe accident, if you're properly belted in, you're very likely to get away with it without any significant injuries. But then the opposite is true. You can be in a minor to moderate accident with you know, moderate forces, but if you're not belted in, the damage that's inflicted on your body, and it can ultimately lead to death, but even, you know, long-term hospital care is very, very significant.
Yeah, absolutely true. And when we come back, we'll have more from Kevin Quinn about teen driver safety, young person driver safety, so stay with us for that. Thanks for being with us right here on America on the Road. I'm Jack Nerad, along with Chris Teague, and stay with us. And let's continue with our interview with Kevin Quinn of Mercury Insurance, talking about teen safety, young person driver safety, and important tips for parents when they think about what cars to get for their children. Let's talk about a key issue with inexperienced drivers, and that's the issue of driver distraction. I mean, certainly distraction is a problem for drivers of all ages, but I think it's particularly important for younger drivers. Tell us about that, what you've learned, Kevin.
Yeah, it's interesting because driver distraction is on the rise over the last several years. And I think for insurance companies, they expected the frequency of accidents to come down a bit as a result of the new technology that's in cars with automatic braking and blindside sighting and, you know, those type of things. But and it has come down a bit, but not as much as we had originally thought. And we attribute that to the rise in driver distraction, particularly among the young drivers.
You know, the cell phone gets clobbered for being the major distraction, and it certainly is a distraction, but it's only one of several distractions, isn't it?
It is, yeah. You know, eating is an issue, and also having other folks in the car is a big problem for young drivers, you know, paying attention to them, particularly in the back seat, turning around and saying something to the person who's in the car with you is a major source of distraction for our young folks. You know, listening to the radio, the stereo, getting lost in a song, all of those things lead to distracted driving and cause a lot of accidents.
Can you quantify distraction as a cause of accidents? Is it 10%? Is it 50%? Is it 80%? Do you have any figures on that?
We don't, you know. Unfortunately, when we talk to folks that were in car accidents, they rarely, if ever, admit to being distracted while they were driving.
Right.
And so we would love to be able to figure that out, but we really don't know like what percentage is actually due to distracted driving. We know it's an issue because the other party will often bring it up and say that the person was on their cell phone or not paying attention, but we don't specifically, we're not able to specifically quantify that.
Yeah. I mean, even if you're lost in thought, and, you know, I think we all are guilty of that at times, but maybe youngsters with so many things going on, you know, what's going on in high school, you know, what college are they going to go to, all of that, they truly have a lot to think about. And that alone can be a distraction, can't it?
It can, yes. And, you know, and they lack the experience to really appreciate the focus that's required to successfully and safely drive a vehicle, you know, because it's not just about you. And they may be thinking, you know, I'm fine, I'm in my lane and I'm aware and I'm not speeding. But when you get distracted and then another driver does something that creates a hazardous condition, you're not in a position to respond quickly to avoid the accident.
Is there any way a parent can help their child avoid distraction? Is it lay down the law? Do you model great behavior? Or what are some of the things you could do?
Yeah, they can actually do provide some real world examples by driving with them and then putting them in situations where they might be distracted. You know, make sure it's safe. You know, not a lot of cars on the road, and maybe have someone else in the car with them, or music, or you know, drop something or something along those lines where you can really teach them the importance of, hey, just pay attention to the driving and your surrounding. And then obviously nothing beats modeling and making sure as a parent that you're driving without distractions. And as distractions come up in the car, you're exhibiting examples where you're really focused on the actual driving and what's happening around you.
Yeah. How about riding as a passenger when your child is driving? I did that, maybe drove my kids a little crazy at times doing that. But I thought I'd learned a lot and maybe taught a little to them as we were doing that. What's your take on all that?
Yeah, that's it's a great opportunity to talk to your child about driving, you know, and once their confidence starts to build, you can create some mini distraction for them to see kind of like how they react to it, and then tell them the importance of, you know, keeping their eyes on the road and not listening to those distractions, you know, even have the phone ring, you know, there's this whole category of FOMO, fear of missing out, and teens have a tendency to respond to incoming texts and phone calls, and they don't want to miss out on what's happening in the moment. And you can create scenarios when you're teaching someone to drive. You can create those kind of scenarios and then talk to them about the importance of making sure that they don't respond to those while they're in the car and actually driving.
Yeah. Let's talk specifically about texts. You know, most kids I know don't answer the phone, especially when I'm calling, but I think they just don't answer the phone. They don't use the phone as a phone. They use it as a text machine. And talk about how distracting it is to both field and then return a text while you're driving.
Yeah, so the I think the feeling amongst teenagers is that this will only take a second. And I'll look down and I'll keep my eyes back on the road. And I'm in pretty good shape right now. I'm just driving along. There are no issues. I also think that, you know, responding to a text is actually a bit more dangerous. Then you really have to focus in on putting the letters in and being precise, and errors come up and things happen, and it takes you a lot longer. And you know, it's unbeknownst to them, they're actually looking down at the phone a lot longer than they think. And that puts them in a position of great vulnerability.
Right. I mean, they're traveling a lot farther at the same time that they're looking down and not paying any attention. And I think when it comes to driving, the ability to multitask is a fairly specious one. I think you really have to concentrate on your driving. And it's so difficult to do that, even if you glance at your phone for a second.
Yes. And I think for more experienced drivers who may have been involved in accidents, they understand how quickly that can happen. And in some cases, it can change your perspective for the rest of your life. You know, but for teens, unless they've actually gone through that experience, they tend to think like, oh, it'll be okay. I'll only look down for a couple of seconds.
All right. Well, let's talk about skills every young driver should possess. Certainly, there are a lot of skills involved in driving a vehicle. It takes coordination, it takes practice, it takes concentration. What do you think some of the top skills are?
Yeah, more than anything else, you know, I think it comes down to a mindset. So for most folks, they can learn how to technically drive a car, how to make a turn, how to stop, how to accelerate, and do all those things. But what's critically important, particularly for young drivers, it's actually true for all drivers, but young drivers seem to struggle more with this, is to really make sure you have your full and undivided attention and focus on driving, so that, you know, if something were to happen, you will be in a position to react quickly and potentially avoid an accident.
One thing we learned, and this is long ago when I was taking driver's ed, I mean, they did have cars then, but it was long ago, was what they called defensive driving. And it seems like that has gone, in some ways, that phrase has gone out of vogue, but it's still the way I approach driving, thinking anybody around me, you know, could end my days, you know, if I'm not paying attention. Talk a bit about having that attitude and how important that is.
Yeah, so defensive driving really, to me, means a full awareness of everything that's happening around you, right? So even if your behavior is good and everything seems calm in the moment, it's just like a focus around, hey, who's to the left of me, who's to the right of me, what are my surroundings? And so if something were to happen, you know, suddenly, you would pick up on it quickly, and then ideally react to it in the appropriate way to avoid the accident. It becomes more of like, hey, a lot of times teenagers will say, you know, I'm a really good driver and I obey the rules of the road. And that might be true, but that's not true for a lot of other folks. And so if you can adopt a defensive driving attitude, meaning in some ways I expect other folks to not be as cautious as me, and I expect this to happen. And so because I'm kind of expecting it and I'm aware, and I've always had that awareness, I'm in a position to be able to react quickly to it and hopefully avoid the accident altogether.
Right. When I was a young driver, I had a motorcycle, and I wasn't a particularly great motorcycle rider or driver, but it did teach me a lot about being defensive, because you are very vulnerable on a two-wheel vehicle like that in traffic with four-wheel vehicles that weigh, you know, 2 to 4 tons. What's your take on that?
Yeah, you know, that's interesting that you say that, because that's exactly what I mean by defensive driving. You know, if you ride a motorcycle, you're hard to see. And so you have to have that defensive driving mindset if you're going to safely operate a motorcycle over time. And really, that's how teenage drivers really need to think about when they're driving in the road. You know, don't assume that even if you're prepared and you're ready, that person next to you is thinking the same way, is equally as prepared, and then they're not going to do something suddenly that you're going to have to react to very quickly.
Right. As a parent, I was always a little concerned about my children driving on the freeway, for example, multi-lane, there's a lot going on, the speeds are high. But there's actually areas that are even more dangerous right in town, very close to your house, and I'm talking about intersections. Those are of critical importance. Talk a bit about that, would you?
Sure, yeah. Like the freeway has more speed, but as long as you're driving within the flow of traffic, that's actually a bit safer statistically than intersections. And when you think about an intersection and, you know, the lights or a stop sign or a left turn, there's a lot that has to go right to enter and exit that intersection safely. And you're relying on a lot of different vehicles doing a lot of the right things all at the same time. And so one thing that more skilled drivers are very aware of is they understand that this is a bit of a danger point for them. And so there's even more heightened awareness about what's happening in this intersection and looking around at the other drivers and making sure they're aware of everything that's happening as they enter the intersection so they can successfully get through it without an accident.
Yeah, I mean, even leaving from a red light turning to green, you don't necessarily want to be the first out into the intersection, do you? You want to be cautious as you approach that intersection all the time, even from a stop.
Yeah. Yes, and like you don't want to make the assumption that someone's not going to run the red light. You know, that does happen. It happens quite often, you know. People aren't paying attention. And so you just, in the back of your mind, as you're proceeding forward, it's a slow acceleration just so that you can see if that's actually happening. And that's the ideal way to kind of think through how do you respond or how do you react in an intersection type environment.
Right. Do you have any statistics on stop sign running? It seems like it's become an epidemic, maybe just an epidemic where I live, but I think there's more and more of this around the country. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I don't have specific statistics on stop signs themselves. I can tell you that intersection accidents overall are very, very high, you know, and with the stop sign, what we often find is one thing you have to be kind of be aware of is sometimes stop signs can be hidden, you know, behind a tree or an overgrown bush or something along those lines. So kind of being familiar with where you drive in the neighborhood is really important. So if you find yourself driving in an area you're not familiar with, you know, an area where you don't specifically know there's a stop sign at that intersection, it's really important to go even slower there and to be more cautious. And we do find that in accidents, the frequency of accidents when you're not familiar with the area is higher, and it's for that reason.
Yeah, it absolutely makes sense. Visibility is also an issue, right? I mean, driving at night, driving in inclement weather. Talk about those issues for young, inexperienced drivers.
You know, you don't want to put yourself into a situation that's dangerous, but I'm actually going to, I would suggest on this one that the driver really should think about practicing being in those environments. And you can put yourself in a situation where you're highly aware, there's not too many vehicles around you, and you want to get more comfortable driving at nighttime where it just is harder to see. And then understanding the importance of being hyper aware in those moments, or if there's slippery weather, you know, or something along those lines, so that you can develop the skills that you'll need in that type of environment, which are actually greater. So I definitely recommend that you practice in environments where it's darker or where it's raining under ideal conditions to get some experience as to what it's like so that when you find yourself in that situation, you have more experience and you're more comfortable with handling it.
Yeah, I mean, getting your kid out in an empty parking lot in the rain and having them drive around a bit, I think makes all the difference in the world. They can really sense some things that they wouldn't sense otherwise.
Yes. And I think for parents, and this has been my experience, it's tougher because you know, I was actually pretty scared when I was teaching my kids how to drive. And I wanted to teach them and get some experience under ideal conditions for my own sanity. But I think it's really important that they get experience in all different types of conditions. So that when they're actually faced with the real world example, they're in a much better position.
Yeah, and I think driving around with your children as they drive at night is very important too.
Yes, I completely agree.
Yeah, give them some practice. How do you feel about professional instruction? I was lucky enough, of course, what I do is review cars for a living, so I have some contacts with some car companies. And one of my daughters actually was able to go to a professional driving school. Actually, this portion of it was designed for teenagers. And I think it meant the world to her to understand driving dynamics. What's your take on that? Should we be looking at doing, you know, much more professional training of our drivers, our young drivers?
Yes, and I only say that because, you know, parents have been driving for a while, and they may have developed some habits that are not conducive to safe driving, you know. And the one thing you'll learn from a professional driving school is the correct way to drive, how to think about things, you know, the positioning of your hands, how to look at the mirrors, all those different things that maybe as an adult we take for granted or is more natural for us, and we may not necessarily point that out to the student, how important that is. But in a professional and driving environment, they will learn all of those skills to help them drive safer.
What's your take on the way we license drivers these days? Should it be more stringent? Should we have, should we wait till they're older to license them? What's your take on that?
You know, I'm biased here. So I think we do it a little bit too early based on my experience because, I think for a lot of our teens, the maturity level doesn't necessarily match the risk associated with driving. And the horrific numbers around teen death do scare me. And in my field, because I'm surrounded constantly by serious accidents, I tend to be a little bit biased here. But I personally think we should wait another year before we actually give out licenses to people in light of the statistics that are out there.
Yeah. And should we be keeping other people out of the car with them for maybe another year or two before they're licensed to drive with passengers?
Yes, and that does two things. I agree with that. They it actually will stop a teenager from having a conversation that's going to lead to an accident or getting distracted by someone in the car. But also, it actually stresses the importance of being paying attention while you're driving when someone else is in the car. So telling a teen driver, hey, for the first year, you can drive under certain circumstances, but you're not to have your friends in the car for a year or two later, and explaining the reasons for that actually could drive home the importance of that, you know, that understanding, and should make everybody safer.
Yeah. Well, and that's absolutely what we want. If you were to sum up two parents out there, the things that they can do to foster the safe driving in their children, what would it be?
It would be really just be the role model. So, and even if your driving habits were not ideal before you thought about, you know, your children learning how to drive, you can change, and that can happen immediately. So in that moment when it's, you know, the teenager is thinking about driving, you have to really be aware that they are going to observe what you're doing, and that you want to make sure that you are extremely safe, and you can even exaggerate the safety issues. Make sure you never speed. Go slow leaving an intersection. Come to a complete stop at a stop sign. Do not have any distracted driving in your car. If something comes up, you can say, hey, I'm driving right now. I'm actually not going to handle that in this moment. You know, those type of things. The teenager will notice. And if you place a priority on it, they will, in most circumstances, place the same priority on it as well.
Makes sense. Right. Do you recommend sitting your child down and speaking to them about it, having a conversation about safe driving and how important it is, both to the parent and child, that take place?
Yeah, I do recommend that. And I also, you know, I think sometimes teens think it's just, this is the way it is, you know, and that it's a right and I get to drive around. And I do believe it's a privilege. And it's really important that we let our teens know that. And they have to earn the privilege to drive. And they have to prove that they're capable of driving safely and they take it seriously before they're going to be allowed to drive on their own.
Yeah, that makes all the sense in the world. And that was our interview with Kevin Quinn of Mercury Insurance, their Vice President of Customer Experience and Claims, talking about teen and young person driver safety. A lot of great tips there, I think, for teens and for parents who have young drivers. So thanks to Kevin Quinn for being with us. And I want to thank Chris Teague, our co-host, for being with us yet again, soldiering through the fact that his tummy hurts and stuff like that. Thanks for getting through this with us, Chris.
I appreciate the opportunity, Jack, and I appreciate everyone listening. But as always, I will say, if you like what you heard and you enjoy our hot takes, which are the best in the business, hit the subscribe button wherever you get your podcast and leave us a review. It helps us trend up the charts and so we can continue to bring you hopefully great content.
Right. And I would also like to remind folks that my book, The GR Factor, Unleashing the Undeniable Power of the Golden Rule, is out there, available at Amazon and wherever books are sold. So look for that. I think if you like the show, you'll probably like this book. It's really about how to treat people, getting the most out of people as a manager, and you get the most out of people by treating them well, is what I've found in my many, many years of management. But look for that. It's from E.M. Lancy Publishers, LLC. And join us again right here next time on America on the Road with Chris Teague. This is Jack Nerad thanking you for being with us and hoping you'll join us again next time right here on America on the Road.